We are privileged to have Rod Oram speak to us today. He has 40 years' experience as a business and financial journalist. He was born in the UK, but has a truly international CV with work in Europe and North America and travel to Asia as well. Unlike most of us, he freely chose to come to New Zealand, immigrating in 1997. Many successful figures in the world of finance overestimate the contribution of their own cleverness to their success. But Rod is enviably down to earth and well aware that there's more to life than growth and profit. He brings quality and a depth of understanding to the field of business journalism and knows enough not to be taken in by corporate spin. Most of us struggle to understand economics and find it a rather arcane discipline. But Rod Oram marshals his information well to provide a clear perspective on his current topic. He does regular interviews for Radio New Zealand and has a column in the Sunday Star Times, among other things. A recent item on the Silver Ferns farm was a welcome contrast to the gushing enthusiasm of Silver Ferns management for the Chinese offer. Rod Oram doesn't just talk the talk, he also walks the talk. He's been known to bicycle to a venue in Auckland where he's speaking, and a year or so ago there was a listener article on his home where he's installed solar power. He has just returned from a three-week overseas trip, 1 week in Beijing, 1 week in London, 1 week in Chicago, with 45 interviews. So I'm sure his head is full of lots of interesting and up-to-date information, but that he won't have had time to process that yet. But still, I expect that he is full of inspiration and has many fresh ideas on what is happening today. So I hand over to Rod Oram.
Thank you very much, Laurie. Kia ora tātou, good morning. And it's a great pleasure to be with you here, especially seeing Diane and Bill Burslem sitting out there. It does feel a bit like the 8 o'clock service at St. Andrew's, and therefore this is one of my occasional sermons. Indeed, I think there's quite appropriate that my main public piece each week is my Sunday Star Times column. I try not to make it too much of a sermon, but I try to bring some of the qualities of a good sermon to it. Thank you very much to you for inviting me to come along today, and I'm very sorry I missed the first 2 days of your conference. Every time I miss the opportunity to hear Lloyd, I know that's a big haul for me, but I was just being down in Christchurch the last couple of days with a speaking engagement. I indeed just did get back from that extraordinary trip. And the reason I took it was, early in the year, a feeling that had been building up for a long time rather overwhelmed me, that there was a lot going on in the world which I didn't understand. Now, that's usually the case, but this was rather more extreme. Rather more importantly, that I'm not sure that many other people understand it either, because what's going on defies conventional economics. And yet, policymakers and businesses and the like are still largely progressing down the road of conventional economics. So I decided to go walkabout, and in order to focus that trip, I wanted to learn more about what's the nexus, what's the link between economy and ecology, and what might that look like in 10 years' time. I decided to focus only on three cities, partly to minimize travel and maximize discussion, but partly because they offered three contrasts, not perfect contrasts in the world. So the first stop was Beijing, the second stop was London. Ideally, it should have been a major city, say São Paulo in Brazil, if one was to get the right range of, or indeed a large African city, to get the right range across the globe. And the third was Chicago. Chicago for two reasons. It's where I went to university, though English. I ended up at university at Northwestern. It's where I met my wife at university. And I did 2 degrees there. That my bachelor's was in economics and politics, and my master's degree was in journalism. As of June 16th this year, I have been a business journalist for 40 years. So I thought it appropriate that I go back to my alma mater and kind of have a bit of a chat with the current students about what the future of business journalism is. So that's the very main reason why I went to Chicago and had that discussion with them. And many of the themes I'm going to lay out this morning were themes I discussed with them in Chicago 10 days ago. And I'm excited that many of those young journalism students are absolutely on to these issues. So that's what I've been up to, and I am indeed still trying to process it. I'm going to do that in various ways. I'm talking about it, and you know that I'm doing it now. That right now, I'm writing about it in my column and talking about it on radio. But I'm also going to be writing. I've been invited to write one of the books in the wonderful Bridget Williams series, the BWB texts. I'm sure you've seen some of them. These small books, physically small this way, slim this way, probably about 20,000 words, which is about the maximum I think I could have managed to write. There's a long time frame for that. That won't appear until about March or April next year. But I hope by then that I will have a clear idea of what's going on. So here's one stab at all of this, and it's, to me, a very central ambition to try and bring these issues together around theology, because, as you'll see, I am going to argue, as I did yesterday in Christchurch in a very different sort of meeting, that there is a spiritual transformation that is absolutely required through all this, and that we as Christians, but indeed all faiths of the world, have a fundamentally important role to play in that. And so this is about how our care of creation will enliven our theology and legitimize our economics. One of the most remarkable thing about economics is that it's value-free, and it's proud of it. I discovered that at university a long time ago in Chicago, not the University of Chicago. And it's value-free in the very fundamental, rather chilling sense, that everything is optimized somehow, and everything is some magnificent trade-off. There is no scope in economic analysis for values. And therefore, I would argue that economics is fundamentally illegitimate. And therefore, I'm trying to work out and explore with people how we might legitimize economics. I'm going to do this in 3 stages. And the first one is I'm going to talk about crises of various kinds. Then I'm going to talk about palliatives of various kinds, because that's all we are doing at the moment. And then I'm going to talk about what I hope theology might look like. I'm absolutely not a theologian, and the best explanation for that is that I'm a lifelong Anglican. And theology has never ranked particularly high in our endeavors. I say this with great fondness and deep commitment to the Anglican Church, but I have never studied theology. I've read so little of it. I'll stop making excuses. In December 2012, the last edition before Christmas, The Economist had a particularly fabulous obituary. Actually, when I read The Economist each week, I turn to the back, I have for decades, and I read the obituary first, because the obituary is the most exquisitely written piece about quite remarkable people, many of whom I've never ever heard of. And therefore, these obituaries are sources of great hope rather than of sadness. And so I was startled to turn on that last edition of the year to the back and to read the obituary, because it was an obituary for the earth, written by Anne Rowe, who at the time was the obituary's editor. I'm not sure she still is. I hope she is. Certainly the quality is undiminished. So I'm going to intersperse this talk this morning by breaking up, it handily does so, into three parts, this obituary. So I'm going to read the first part to you. And it's quite complicated poetry style from centuries past. But don't worry, it's going to be all there in the PDF at the end if you want to have a read of it. Weep, harp, the end of that exquisite place that every circling planet did outface, mother of streams and mountains, vales and trees, and every prospect that the lens could please. Cradle of man and his sustaining nurse, whether for better or, in this case, worse. Long time that orb turned tranquilly and bright, blue shining like a marble in the night. Long time all hunky-dory-ish appeared, but man was greedier than it had been feared, flattening the forests and with grasping hand pumping out oil from every desert land. Then anxious greens announced that doom was nigh, though all the rest uncaring wondered why. And to consumerism blithely turned, tapping their iPhones while the planet burned, checking each bleep of instantaneous chat until they hardly knew where they were at. And so, overheated and in quite a tangle, poor Earth was now beset from every angle. I was born in 1950 in the middle of England, and the human population at that time was only 2.5 billion people. That today is the number of people who live in India and China. So in other words, when I was born, the entire population lived only in India and China, and nobody else lived anywhere else in the world. And it's that sense of the population growth, we're now up to about 7.3 billion people, we're probably heading for 10. And if I live to be 100, which is one of my goals, the human population will have quadrupled in my lifetime. And, of course, the demand of each human on the ecosystem will have radically more than quadrupled because of the way we live. So as a person, as a husband, father, parishioner, journalist, that is the central thing that kind of occupies my mind in terms of how on earth could 10 billion people live well within the ecosystem. And that's actually a question of economics of a legitimate kind. Let me give you just a few snapshots of what's going on around the world. In June and July of 2013, my wife Lynn and I fulfilled a long-standing ambition. We had wanted for 20 years to make the pilgrimage walk to Santiago de Compostela. One of our first major stops was Pamplona in late May, where there had just been riots over austerity and the rest. I had tried to exercise my rights as a global citizen to use my ATM card in any machine I wanted to extract cash, and found I couldn't. It was a small sample of how global systems, while apparently ubiquitous, can break down. This is from a very august accounting firm, PwC, and a very good analyst, Oxford Economics. We won't dwell on the detail here. You just need to see that there's an accelerating rate of financial crises, whether in the US, that's the black ones below the line, or internationally, the red ones above the line. I found the global financial crisis quite extraordinary for all sorts of reasons. I reached a kind of zen-like state of unshockability on September the 15th, 2008. I was in South America on a trip looking at New Zealand dairy farming investments across South America. I was sitting in a hotel room in São Paulo, Brazil that morning, preparing to do my regular Tuesday morning 9 to noon piece, being the other side of the dateline, it was still Monday. And I was trying to process two things. First of all, I was still reeling from Fonterra's melamine scandal in China with Sanyu, which had happened, the news broke earlier the previous week. And at about 1 a.m. New York time that morning, Lehman Brothers had gone into bankruptcy. And this had been all building for a long time. And what struck me that morning, hence my Zen-like state of unshockability, was that anything could happen. I wasn't relaxed about that. It's just I was no longer surprised. But the other aspect was the extraordinary interconnectivity of the world. So all the way through the global crisis, it still happens today, that something big happens in some part of the world, and you think, gosh, that's really interesting. And then a day or so later, perhaps even shorter, some completely unexpected, certainly unintended consequence happens somewhere else in the world. And you think, good grief, what's the connection between those? So I was sitting there in that hotel room trying to understand that. And in a very fundamental way, not anything much has changed since. There is some slightly different regulation of banks, but even these 7 years on from the global financial crisis, which I actually don't believe is over, I should phrase it in the seventh year of the global financial crisis, we just see how one market after another has been rigged, to use this word from the New York Times earlier this year. And this most recent one was foreign exchange, but there have been many others. There was a wonderful phrase when this was hit the news in May. There was a wonderful quote from a transcript from True Traders discussing how they were going to rig the foreign exchange market. And the quote was, "If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying." As of a month or so ago, which was the last time I looked, the data is being compiled by a wonderful academic at the London School of Economics. So far in the US alone, 10 banks have been fined a total of $400 billion, but only one person's gone to jail. And so the sense that we're not really getting to the bottom of this is as strong as ever. But it's not just about finance. When I thought that I couldn't be shocked any longer, the news Thursday of the week before last, 10 days ago, that Volkswagen had been installed a software device in many of its engines to defeat emission standards, I thought was, it really took me aback, quite honestly. And so here's a photograph of Paris on a good day. And Paris is now one of the most polluted cities in the world. One of the reasons is that diesel cars have been spectacularly successful in France. And at their peak, almost about 65% of new cars sold were diesels. Now a very progressive new mayor of Paris is threatening to ban diesels from the city by 2020. But what we learned in that story was that Volkswagen was desperate to get back into the US market. Its ambition was to be the largest car maker in the world. It couldn't do that if it wasn't a lot more successful in the US. It couldn't meet emission standards for nitrogen oxides, particularly harmful to health. Probably about 2 million people a year, we think, die from that sort of smog from cars worldwide. And it prided itself on its technology that it could solve that problem, and indeed it did. It was a very easy fix. It just wrote some software that the engine could work out when it was being tested. That's very simple because the front wheels are on a dynamometer, so the engine runs and everything else, but the back wheels aren't moving. So in the test mode, this traction control is disengaged, so it's not a complicated thing for the car to understand when it's being tested. Sorry, that was a bit more anthropomorphic than I meant it to be. And so the engines performed very lean and clean on test, but very dirty on the road, emitting up to 40 times the nitrogen oxides allowed by law in the United States. But, of course, it wasn't just the 482,000 engines in cars that they sold in the U.S. between 2008 and 2015. It was actually 11 million engines worldwide. potentially in the US alone, where the fine is $37,500 per car, its liability is $18 billion. Now, I don't think there'd be a person on the planet who believes that Volkswagen is going to be paying fines of $18 billion. So this is the world that we work in and live in. The World Economic Forum, the people who bring us Davos each year, the great titans of this system, do worry about this. Each year they do a risk analysis in time for the Davos Forum. This is the one from 2012. I won't dwell on the detail. You'll see it in the PDF, but essentially impact of the likelihood of a risk goes this way and the impact is that way. So if you're up here in the top right-hand corner, that's where the likelihood is high and the impact's huge. So we have water supply crisis, food shortage crisis, chronic fiscal imbalances, extreme volatility in energy and agricultural products, severe income inequality, to name a few. Interestingly, religious disturbances are comfortably in the middle. Moderate likelihood, moderate impact. Simplifying that, when the World Economic Forum thinks about this, it thinks the solution is global governance. So it worries that all this will break down if global governance fails. That's true, but I think it's wildly optimistic that it's possible for human beings to construct rules and regulations, i.e. a form of governance, that could prevent some engineers at Volkswagen taking a gamble. I asked myself, what was in their minds, what was in their hearts when they did that? So that's pretty unrealistic, that somehow global governance is the key to all this. However, insofar as I think there might be a solution, it's probably even wildly more unrealistic. But then ideals exist not only in order not to be realized. I think ideals exist because they change reality, even if you fall far short of it. And so that ideal is that if we had some sort of cultural and spiritual transformation, maybe many more of us would be making right decisions without the necessity of scanning or scrutinizing the word of the law, and we lived much more by the spirit of it. So the World Economic Forum asked itself, is the Occupy movement, dormant I think for now, but will certainly resurface, an anomaly or a harbinger? And it concluded it absolutely was a harbinger. If this starts to unravel, if global governance fails, then it leads to this tangle of issues that we're all very familiar with. That's part of the picture, but in many ways here is, no, I take that back. Here is the ultimate issue that overarches all of this. This is the work of the Stockholm Resilience Institute, been going on for many years, and they identify the nine biophysical limits to the planet. And this is a measure of by them of how we are overshooting those. Now, we focus a lot on climate change, which is right, and we see that's a moderate overshoot so far, although we're certainly on track for big. And then the nitrogen cycle is because of how we grow food. We massively subsidize nature, to use the phrase, by importing a lot of energy to make things grow more. That's nitrogen fertilizers. That's what's leaching into our waterways, into our aquifers. But by far the biggest overshoot is biodiversity loss. And when we think about what utter unsustainability looks like, we have to think hard about that. Our issues, in a sense, are rather different from Volkswagen's, although there's great parallels with, say, our dairy industry, which I make in my column this morning. But let's just consider for a moment these two extraordinary creatures of creation. The fairy tern, there are 14 breeding pairs left in eternity, and Maui dolphins, possibly 55 left. We are threatening their natural environments, their homes, their ecosystems, because we are going to be searching for oil offshore in their territories. This is crazy at many levels, not the least of which the oil companies of the world already have on their balance sheets more reserves than we could ever burn if we aren't to cook the planet. In fact, a conservative estimate is three times as much. So the idea that we should threaten life by searching for more oil seems to me fundamentally valueless. And so with each death, with each species extinction, we snip away one more thread in the web of life. The planet's been here before five times. There have been five great extinctions. All were created by natural phenomenon. Out of them came wildly different life forms. We are the apex of the life form that evolved from the last great extinction. This is our first great extinction, the sixth, but it's also the first that humankind has caused. We are the Anthropocene. We are the geological era where we humans are fundamentally reshaping the nature of the planet. So palliatives. Here's part two of the obituary. This the wise Mayer long ago foresaw, that in the age of tricky Seven Macaw, or to put finger firmly onto fact, in 2012, December 21st exact, history's great wheel would tumble to eclipse quicker than an email through the ether zips, from fiery sun with Milky Way aligned would make a pretty mess of things combined. The poles would flip, and old terrestrial time fade out with eternity's vast climb. The law of gravitation, grown a feat, would scarce secure an infant in his seat. And all that normal seemed the day before would now essay the air or hit the floor. Then monumental panic spread abroad, skins to preserve and groceries to hoard, for though the mathematics seemed obscure, nobody's fate might be considered sure. So petroglyphs of rockets upside down were scrutinized in every part of town. To some extent, business thinks about this, and people who dwell on economics. One guide is the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, some major companies there. And in 2050, they produced Vision 2050, and I'll show you two charts. This is our state of play, if you like. Across the bottom is the United Nations Human Development Index. Every dot is a country. We have a lot of well-developed countries. We have a long tail of countries and people not. The vertical axis is the ecological footprint that each person requires. The higher dotted line is in 1961, and the lower dotted line is 2006. And it's fallen because more people and each of us more demands on the ecosystem. So, oh, it doesn't quite show up. Down the bottom, there is a little blue square, which is where we would have high development within the biosphere. There is not a single country in that box. It's already 2015. We've got a lot to do in the next 35 years. This is an attempt to look at people's values, human development, economy, agriculture, forests, energy, power, buildings, transport, materials across the bottom. These are all the big changes. Again, you'll see all this clearly in the PDF, or you can download the report. So up to 2020, these were must things we had to do big if we were to stand any chance of doing the bigger stuff above. So this is absolutely an unprecedented scale, speed, and complexity of change that humankind has never come within cooey of before. There are explorers, there are signposts along the way. McDonough, an American architect, and his great partner in this, Braungart, Michael Braungart, a German chemist, talk about how we need to return to nature. So anytime we take something from nature, we need to return it to nature. this isn't recycling, because most recycling is a downcycling. You know, the next use is a poorer quality than the one before. And this is about being able to make things so we can completely unmake them down to parts per billion, and therefore recycle as nature does. We make small steps. This is the first living building in the world, so designated very demanding criteria that it meets all its energy and water needs. And nature is a great guide. So one of the interesting areas of technology that helps is biomimicry, where we borrow technology from nature. So in the top, in the middle there, is an office, a modern office complex in Harare, in Zimbabwe. Harare is high up on a plateau, so it's hot during the day and cold at night. These buildings have no mechanical heating, ventilation, or cooling, because their airflows are modeled on those of an ant heap. I think it's a useful metaphor, but it's that sense that if we borrowed genuinely from nature, we would do an awful lot. How do we bring this together, though? Kate Raworth, who was one of the people I had a great long chat with 2 weeks ago in Oxford, is one of my heroines in this. Kate conceives of the donut economics. So the lower ring there is the social foundation on which society has to be built if this is to be a strong society where this sort of cultural and spiritual and technological and every other kind of transformation you can imagine happens. So, of course, it's about food, water, income, education, resilience, voice, jobs, energy, social equity, gender equity, and health. The outer ring are those planetary boundaries I showed you earlier, the nine. So that's the environmental ceiling and the social floor. Between the two is the safe and just place for humanity where inclusive and sustainable economic development can happen. Another guide on the way, Jonathan Porritt, indeed son of our first New Zealand-born Governor-General, has a long and continues to have a distinguished career in these issues overseas in the UK. Do read his book, readily available, The World We Made. Looking back from 2050, in a very steely-eyed, strong-eyed dog look at how this might be done. And indeed, there is a New Zealand version of 2050 done by some of our great leaders about how 6 million people could live well in New Zealand by 2050, well within our ecosystem's boundaries. And again, you can download that. And here's Tūhoe's glorious, glorious building in the Uruweras, which is the first living building in New Zealand. I show this not just because I admire the building, but because it tells us, I think, something very important. This looks nothing like the Bullitt building in Seattle, the first living building in the world, and that's right. We have to draw on our great cultural depth, our great history, this place that where we are, to do these things in ways which are uniquely us. We shouldn't try to be some pale imitation of some other cultural country. And therefore, I'm immensely fond of this building, because it gives expression of something immensely powerful from a technology point of view, but it brings that cultural dimension to it as well. So we are responsible for the fourth largest oceanic resource in the world. We know very little about it. We are starting to exploit it in unconscionable ways. So if we can find ways to bring these issues to bear not just on land in New Zealand, but fundamentally, importantly, at sea too, because after the Antarctic oceans, our oceans have the highest level of endemic species, i.e. unique species in the world, then we can do something really important. And likewise in Antarctica too. So how does this all come together in economics and ecology and theology in a way that helps us on care of creation, legitimizes our economics, and enriches our theology? The last part of the Earth obituary. And some to Bergerac in France repaired, where it was said their lives would all be spared by alien beings in a cave confined. But bugger off, declared the mayor unkind. A few were saved, for such escapes must be as shown forth on reality TV, where jabbing Digit points towards the door, but some survive into round 24. And so the wise soared up to realms of dreams, bathed by galactic synchronization beams. The rest, when pulling on their morning socks, asked what the hell was wrong with all the clocks and why each mug would from the table rise, floating about before their bleary eyes, and why their phones no signal would receive, save the implicit one that they should leave. Crazed, then, the uninformed or unprepared rushed to the street and round them wildly stared, seeing approach an overwhelming snow before they had worked out which way to go, and they were buried deep, the ice beneath, with crumbs of croissant still between their teeth. Another great guide, Gus Speth, a wonderful American scientist, founder of the World Resources Institute 40-odd years ago, Helen Clark's predecessor, but one at the United Nations in UN Development Program. On BBC Radio, and there's a link to it, I urge you to listen to it. At the time, he was headed the School of Forestry and Environment at Yale. He's since retired. But in that, he said, I used to think the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that with 30 years of good science, we could address those problems. But I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with those, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that. Another guide. I have a daughter who's wonderful in many ways. But one way she is particularly wonderful is that on Father's Day, the American Father's Day, because she's now studying in the States, she's a musician, she's a composer trying to work out how music can help us in this, sent me this book, Learning to Die in the Anthropocene. It's a stunning, startling book by Roy Scranton. And this quote does not do justice to him, but what does the title mean? It sort of means this. The greatest challenge we face is a philosophical one, understanding that this civilization is already dead. The sooner we confront our situation and realize there is nothing we can do to save ourselves, the sooner we can get down to the difficult task of adapting with mortal humility to the new reality. One more guide. In 1942, at the depths of the Second World War, Alan Kernow wrote Landfall in Unknown Seas. Of course, ostensibly, he was talking about Tasman's bloody murderous encounter in Golden Bay with indigenous people. But I love this poem because to me it is absolutely as relevant today as it would have been 373 years ago, whatever the maths is, or in 1942. A short extract that doesn't do justice to the whole poem. But now there are no more islands to be found, and the eye scans risky horizons of its own in unsettled weather, and murmurs of the drowned haunt their familiar beaches. Who navigates us towards what unknown but not improbable provinces? Who reaches a future down for us from the high shelf of spiritual daring? So, three words, which is my feeble attempt to try to bring this together. The word ecology is from the Greek word oikos, which is home. And as I think we understand, the planet is our home. We can't escape it, nor should we want to. Very interestingly, the word economy comes from the Greek word oikonomia, which was about stewardship of a household. Simply told, that had three obligations as a head of a household, to look after your family, to look after a wider circle of people you're responsible for, slaves, staff, I suppose employees. And the third one was a duty to your society, to civic engagement. Stewardship's a very difficult word. As a Christian singing Harvest Festival hymns, I guess I'd got beyond dominance over God's creation. I kind of spent a long time around stewardship. But it occurred to me a long time ago that we can't possibly be stewards of something that is so infinitely extraordinary and remarkable and complex, that how could we ever be stewards of it? We have to listen to that creation. We have to be guided by that creation. We can't sit back and pretend that we can kind of benignly run it. So I don't like the word stewardship. And so in pursuit of a theology that expressed something more realistic and sensible than the word stewardship, about our subordinate role in creation, I think would be helpful, essential. Then there's ethics, which is about a moral principle from the Greek ethos about the nature or disposition. So I absolutely, deeply, deeply believe that the ethics of ecology has to be the ethics of economics, because that's the right pecking order. So it's about how we look after ourselves, our place, our planet, how we restore those right relationships with each other and the planet. I've thought for a long time, as I noticed powerfully in São Paulo on September the 15th, 2008, that these issues are increasingly global, that interdependence, but they're increasingly local, because we need to achieve this extraordinary transformation, but we can only do so if we have very strong learning communities, which seems to me have three essential attributes. The first one is a common sense, a common understanding of what needs to be done. The second one is a common purpose. We know what we're going to try to do. And the third one is common wealth. There is benefit in which we all share. So these are communities. It could be a family, a neighborhood, a street, a neighborhood, a part of a town, a whole town, a province, a whole small country, where individuals are valued, helped, and encouraged. So in return, they participate, they change. So in other words, this is about making the most of our God-given potential. So, look, I'm very superficial on theology, but here's my first faltering steps on this. So if it's about our understanding of God, three things seem to me very important. The first is about the extraordinary gift of God's radical abundance. This, in a very, very real world, is not a finite planet. It is in the sense that sometime the sun will burn out. We can really screw up the systems as the planetary boundaries show us, and so it seems awfully finite. But we know that that's a radical, radical abundance of God in many other ways. So theology is also about our relationship between God and his or her or its creation and us. It's about redemption. It's about being made whole. It's about knowing how we as whole people fit in the whole ecosystem and play our infinitely small, inconsequential part in the whole. We are consumers of what God has made. We are in communion with it, Rowan Williams said some years ago. So a lot of this is kind of a faith, really, about what this all means and how we respond to God, a belief that then perhaps empowers us a bit and helps us achieve some degree, however small, of enlightenment. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. Albert Einstein. I'm actually fascinated that many, many fabulous, fabulous scientists who work to exacting disciplines of proof and evidence and tests are also great people of faith. So community is about how we act on our understanding of God, how we relate to each other, how we discuss things with each other, and how we understand each other. The great faiths of the world have moments, fleetingly, of modeling this, but often long eons of not. Religious wars or religious intolerance, or it goes on and on. I'm deeply intrigued, though, that care of creation is probably one thing the great faiths of the world could agree on, if they, even though they think that there are more important things that they can't agree on and therefore won't get round to doing the other stuff. I would argue that if we tried to work on these sorts of issues about our home and creation, we would achieve great things to support each other and to act together. Two Latin words, inspiration, because this is a world that desperately needs inspiration. From the Latin, inspirare, to breathe into, as in spirit. This is a world that also needs enthusiasm, a sense of wonder about what can be done, what we can do. And so that's from the Greek, enthos, possessed by a god. So the opportunity is that we should be good at this when we, people of faith, try not to be too judgmental or sectarian or whatever, human. We can bring people together, and therefore maybe we can play some role in these interlinked global crises. And as I said, paradoxically, the best response is local, multiplied off across a community, a town, a province, a small country, a region of the world, the world. But the challenge is immense. We have to apply a timeless faith, an understanding of these issues, to contemporary responses, which is about action. I was thrilled by Pope Francis's encyclical. I think it's a truly beautiful, and I don't mean that word in a superficial way, expression of these issues. It's immensely valuable. It's important that he could go to the United Nations last week and talk of these things. However, I think we have a long way to go as people of faith before we can try to reach out to people on these issues. I'm not sure that however wonderful Pope Francis's encyclical is, as it is, that it is necessarily particularly persuasive to people who don't have some sense that there is a need for something else in life, that there is a need for some sort of cultural or spiritual transformation. And so that's still, in a way, a missing link as to what we need to do. Words matter, and I am intrigued by Marcus Borg's view in Speaking Christian about how we have used words and how we might reclaim words, which might be useful in this task. So salvation has come to mean life after death, but in the Bible, Borg argues, it is seldom about an afterlife. Rather, it is about transformation this side of death. So imagine the transformation we need here and now. Redemption is now largely seen about being saved from sin, but in the Bible, redemption is about being freed from slavery. So imagine freedom from modern enslavement, such as inequitable and valueless economic systems. And righteousness is now about individual virtue. But in the Bible, it's often a collective virtue. So imagine a world of justice for all, social, economic, environmental, and in all its forms. So, above all, we must ensure that we speak the truth, the vague glimmer of truth we think we see, with power, simplicity, and beauty. Sometimes at St. Andrew's, as part of our communion service, we say this. Loving God, you promise a world where those who weep shall laugh, and those who are hungry shall feast. Those who are poor and excluded shall have the kingdom for their own. We want this world too. We renounce despair. We will act for change. We choose to be included in the great feast of life. One last quote. Actually, first, the picture. You'll recognize Christ the Redeemer in Rio de Janeiro. I was in Rio in July 2012 for the Rio Plus 20 conference, 55,000 people from around the world, trying to work out how much progress had been made since the great sustainability declarations of Rio in 1992. Governments of the world produced a 283-paragraph final statement, which was utterly appalling. They never used the word will or must or should or have, or very rarely. Kumi Naidu, the head of Greenpeace International, tweeted, it was the longest suicide note in history. Quite marvelously, it remains one of my favorite tweets. I wish I could tweet like that. But really importantly, the vast majority of official delegates there, of the 55,000, were from civil society. And when governments completely failed to do anything the least bit meaningful or useful, it was civil society that responded. There was this extraordinary outflow of voluntary commitments from cities around the world, from countless organizations from across the planet, from this great community of humankind. And I left Rio rather more buoyed up. I took this picture on the Sunday before Rio Plus 20 started. It was the only day of bad weather in Rio, and quite marvelously, Christ the Redeemer was shrouded in mist. So that's why the picture's here. But the quote's from somewhere quite different. It's Catherine Jeffert Scurry, the presiding bishop, Episcopal bishop in the United States, from a sermon of hers in Washington a few years ago. Let the pain of the world seize us by the throat. Listen for Jesus calling us out of our tombs of despair and apathy. This place we call home is meant to be a new heaven, a new earth, a holy city, a new Jerusalem. It is the sparks in the stubble that make it so. Thank you.
Yeah, John Warren.
I guess maybe just on behalf of everybody here, I'd just like to say thank you. Like, it was just quite remarkable. So, and the suicide note, I think, is something to remember. But going back to one of your comments on Volkswagen, it brought something to mind for me, the O-rings on the space shuttle.
Yes.
And the engineers said, don't do it. And you said, what was in the hearts and minds of the engineers? I wonder whether it's possible that what was in the hearts and minds of the engineers and what they were being told to do by other parts of the corporation was a factor.
I remember the story very vividly because I was night foreign news editor at the Financial Times when that happened, and so the night was preoccupied with trying to report on and make sense of what happened. I remember it as vividly. Almost today is the day it happened. I will say one thing about it. As I looked at that many years later, and I came across this quite by chance, I was trying to work out, I was trying to say something useful about how we deal with complexity. And one thing led to another, as it marvelously does on the internet. And I found a person in the States who uses visual language very powerfully to make complex things true but understandable. And one of the examples on his website he used was the PowerPoint presentation that Boeing engineers had used. This wasn't O-rings. It was the second space shuttle disaster. The same issue applies. About how engineers at Boeing had used a PowerPoint demonstration or presentation to persuade NASA there was no danger from a bit of foam insulation coming off during launch, which, of course, did hit the heat-resistant tiles of Columbia, and it burnt up on re-entry. And so, to me, the important part of that story is that in trying to deal with enormous complexity in the world, we massively oversimplify things. We want to cut to the chase, get to the core of things, get to the heart. Well, interesting language. We say we get to the heart of the matter, but I think perhaps what the problem is, the heart is missing in the matter. Because if we are trying to deal with very complex things and our hearts are telling us something that our minds don't quite understand, then we should listen to our hearts. And so the question of the O-rings, the question of the phone on the second shuttle disaster, or the question of Volkswagen, or it goes on kind of infinitely through humankind's failures. It's where our brains have oversimplified, have over-rationalized something, and have completely overridden our hearts, which is our soul, and which is the spirit of this, I think.
Rod Grace Adden, what is your opinion of the impact of the Sustainable Development Goals? Is it a way forward or is it another suicide note?
They are a way forward. And they're importantly a way forward in two respects. First of all, the Millennium Development Goals before them were focused on, rightly, the very poorest, most disadvantaged people in the world. It was very much focused on developing countries. Whereas the Sustainable Development Goals don't make that distinction. And I think that's incredibly important because the level of impoverishment in the world transcends artificial boundaries like that. So that's the first point. The second point is there is a much greater emphasis in the Sustainable Development Goals compared with the Millennium Development Goals out of the United, all this being the United Nations work, is that there is more of that sense of learning to do, needing to do, having to do all this within the limits of our ecosystem. Now, of course, the UN is an extraordinarily chaotic and wild and ineffective and improbable institution. But having said that, it's kind of the best we've got at that. I am very supportive of the Sustainable Development Goals, and I think they are a step forward. But, of course, we all recognize that as articulate as they are and well-focused as they are, actually making them work will be a Herculean task.
Rod, you said one of the issues was to understand other people. I believe that perhaps one of the issues, probably more important issues, is to understand ourselves. And therefore, the sustainable economics really depends upon the evolution of the individual, which takes a very long time.
It does. And you're absolutely right. It is about us. It's about each of us in our immensely imperfect way, trying to understand this and do the best we can. So I talk about community, but of course, a community starts with each individual in that community. I was reminded yesterday of an Ed Hillary quote, "It's not the mountains we conquer, it's ourselves."
Well, I have a couple of small things to thank Rod Oram for. One is explaining to me how Volkswagen managed to do this, to set up this test that would kind of fake good results when it's connected to the machine and then behave differently otherwise. And the other small thing is you confirm a long-standing and quite deep prejudice that I have going back to my time in Germany, that Anglicans and theology don't really mix. Now, that's not a criticism of what you said in the third part at all. I respect the kind of fragmentary nature, and I guess all of our theology is like that, really. If I may be permitted to tell a little story, my sister and I both grew up in a liberal Baptist church, and our minister was a mountaineer in his younger years, and he actually made some first ascents. One of them was Mount Heim. So he was an enthusiast for German theologians, but unfortunately, I think Karl Barth was his. It was either Barth or Brunner was his kind of all-time favourite theologian. But the name had already been claimed for another peak, so he couldn't name it with that theologian. So he had to call it Mount Heim. But the British Weekly reported on this and lamented. Why did he have to pick a German theologian? Surely there were plenty of good Anglican theologians that he could have chosen, English speaking theologians. So there we have it. So once again, you've shown us another side to you that we weren't really aware of, your understanding and appreciation of poetry, and you've. I'm not sure that I can get my thoughts together very, very well on this, but you've certainly given us a wide-ranging and deeply thought-provoking presentation. Just a few thoughts for the core groups. One of the things that stood out for me was the idea that economics is value-free. That there's no values in economics itself, so we have to bring them from outside. The relationship between economics and ecology. And I was a little bit surprised that you're speaking directly of God and to God. One thought for all you non-theists and post-theists out there. None of us are really empiricists. None of us believe only in the facts of the matter as they are. We all have some kind of values or perspective or convictions or something that stands out over against the world as it actually is right now. So in that sense, we all have something kind of unprovable, some kind of conviction that we bring to the world. So it's not really appropriate to look down your nose at someone who talks of God. Thank you.